Thank you for listening to Mormon Sex Info. This episode is an archived episode and is only now becoming publicly available. Mormon Sex Info relies on contributions. To contribute, please visit mormonsex.info. And now, please enjoy this episode.
Hello and welcome to Mormon Sex Info. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today I am just really thrilled to have Lexi, the sister Lexi from Beauty Redefined, and there's two of them. They're identical twins, I think, right?
Yep.
Right, Lexi? Okay, Lindsay and Lexi. Well, today I have Lexi, and I just came across Beauty Redefined. I don't know why I haven't come across this sooner, because tons of people knew about it when I talked about it. I'm like, well, where have I been? So okay. Really exciting to learn about another resource, kind of a body positive, sex positive resource. And it's Utah based. And I'm going to turn the time over to Lexi to just kind of explain to us a little bit more about this website that they have and the work that they're doing. And also, if you wouldn't mind giving us a little bit about your background, both professionally and personally.
Yeah, I can do that.
All right.
For that introduction, and I'm so glad you now know about Beauty Redefined. I think you are wonderful and love all of your work.
Oh, thanks.
My sister and I are 32 years old. We are identical twins. We did our master's degrees and our PhDs together at the U. We didn't plan to do it that way, but the fates collided to make sure that we were twins on a mission together. So we established the nonprofit Beauty Redefined in 2009 in conjunction with getting our master's degrees. Our research is in body image and media, and what we do is the work of body image resilience. So through Beauty Redefined, our website at beautyredefined.org, a lot of social media activism, a lot of, you know, media interviews and live speaking events, we preach to the world, especially at universities, about how to see more than bodies and be more than bodies. So our entire foundation is based upon the fact that women are more than bodies. And that is a simple message that flies in the face of so many media ideals and cultural ideals, including ideals within religious cultures and Mormonism specifically, that place so much emphasis on women as bodies first. So our work has definitely resonated with people in Mormonism. Lindsay and I are ourselves Mormon, very progressive, feminist. So you can imagine that that can sometimes be difficult.
Yeah.
But we've definitely found a place for ourselves where we've gotten a lot of traction within the church and even been able to meet with higher ups in the church about helping them with things like modesty rhetoric that can be very problematic. That's something we've spoken about for many years and have posted about and gone viral many a time. So we can talk a little bit more about that,
I'm sure. Yes, for sure. I have that on my list.
Yeah. So Lindsay and I both live in Salt Lake, downtown. I'm married and I have a baby that will be 2 next month and a really amazing husband. Yeah. How's that?
Awesome. That's great. No, thank you so much. So why don't we dive into you telling me a little bit more about the actual research that you did for your PhD? Can you tell
us absolutely.
What that was about, who you were studying, what questions you were trying to answer?
So if I step back even a little bit further from the PhD, this work began when Lindsay and I were both freshmen in college. We were at Utah State University taking a required course for all journalists. That's where we did our undergrads.
Okay.
And the very first day we started learning about how women were presented in media, why it was incredibly profit-driven, and just like the very first basic concepts about how that might skew the way women experience their own bodies and how they feel about themselves and their body image. That was just a light bulb moment that took us down 10 years of college without a break to not only help people recognize the really harmful ways women are presented in media, in social media, and in our cultural ideals, but better yet, not just get people mad about it, not just open their eyes, but help them to find a way out. Mm-hmm. And I did that in my dissertation research by beginning by focusing on this theory, self-objectification theory, which is formative to our research. We speak about this in a public way that no other public intellectuals or public scholars really do. It's amazing, groundbreaking work. So the idea of self-objectification is that girls and women live in a near constant state of picturing themselves living instead of just living. So we have this doubled identity that most girls and women in the U.S. are experiencing from the time they are hitting puberty until they die.
And just to be clear too, your work mainly focuses on women, correct?
Yes.
Not so much the messages, because that's kind of another topic, is messages men get. So just to be clear that this is female-centric right now.
Mm-hmm. Specifically on girls and women and the experiences they have in their bodies.
Yes.
Yes. So when we look at like the world girls and women live in, growing up in a world that begs them to believe their bodies are the most important thing about them, that their value will come from the way their bodies look, that their sexuality will be experienced through how they look, through how others consume them. You know, it goes on and on and on. Mm. What I found was that in this self-objectification theory, there is no way out. The theory just describes all the negative consequences of living in an objectifying world, which leads to the self-objectification of each girl and woman on her own. Mm-hmm. So self-objectification leads to a host of terrible consequences. It leads to things like girls and women performing extremely poorly when they're in a state of self-consciousness compared to when they're not, in all areas, from academic areas like math and reading comprehension, spatial skills, to, you know, physical fitness areas like throwing a softball or lifting weights. But it leads into relationships, and we can talk about what that does for, you know, it lowers your sexual assertiveness, your ability to say no. If you believe that your body is the most important thing about you and a guy is paying attention to your body, then yeah, at all costs, yes, do whatever he wants to do. That's bringing you value. So basically, long story short, sorry, I feel like I'm rambling.
No, but, no.
What I did was meld self-objectification. Oh, good. Okay. What I did in my research that it felt really powerful was I melded the theory of self-objectification with resilience theory and the model of resilience, which is a pathway out of this place of self-objectification. Instead of just swirling around the drain of the consequences of self-objectification, from disordered eating to a life of body shame, cosmetic surgery, the list goes on, you can get out of that by choosing one of three paths. And the path you want to choose is being able to rise with resilience. And we do that in my dissertation research. I identified several traits that girls and women can learn. Some of them are innate and others you can learn, that fit into four sources of power: mental, physical, spiritual, and social, that can help you get out, to shine a light on the objectification that you experience in your life and the pain that brings, and to use that pain to become stronger, not just in spite of the pain, but because of the pain you experience in your body. And it's been really profound. That's what we do through our live speaking events and what we try to share in social media in all sorts of formats.
Okay, so I'd like to wait just a minute to get into those resiliency things and instead focus a little bit more on just the consequences piece. You mentioned several, you know, body shaming and body or disordered eating, plastic surgery. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the types of things specifically that have to do with sexual performance or sexual experiences that women have when it comes to this type of messaging that, you know, and I often talk about it in the sense of who's allowed to be sexy in our culture, right?
Who's
and there's a very small percentage of people, and even people who fit that kind of stereotype that come into my office still are struggling with body image. It's not like if you
fit
that stereotype, I just want those to know that just because you fit that stereotype doesn't mean that automatically you have all this great body self-esteem. So do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Oh, I could talk about it all day long.
Okay, let's do that. Well, for an hour, I guess.
Yes, I'll do it. I could talk about this from a few different perspectives. And the first, I can talk about it through the negative consequences of self-objectifying. So most of us live in this very normal state of living and also picturing ourselves being looked at. And it's kind of this mental task list that's constantly in your head, where if you are sitting in a classroom, instead of thinking about what you're learning, you've got this task list that says, oh, you should have washed your hair. The people sitting behind you probably see how greasy your hair is. And you need to cross your legs or adjust your legs in some way because they look really big the way you're sitting and people are looking at how big your legs are, blah, blah, blah. The list goes on. Right. So in terms of sex and intimacy and experiencing your body, self-objectification is directly linked to poorer sexual functioning. So obviously the inability to have an orgasm. If you are picturing what you look like instead of experiencing anything, including sex, my goodness, you're not going to enjoy it. You're there for somebody else's pleasure. It has nothing to do with your own. Mm-hmm. Self-objectification is also linked to decreased sexual assertiveness, which includes the ability to say no and to bring up contraception in any way. That is terrifying to me for the many young women and older women that should be taking care of number one first. And instead they're thinking, I'm just grateful this guy's attracted to me. And so I'll do whatever it takes. Oof, sounds awful. Mm-hmm. In my dissertation study, I worked with women ages 18 to 35 along the Wasatch Front. My sister did as well. We had separate dissertations that focused on different components of this work. And with my participants, many of whom were LDS, they experienced these exact things, these negative consequences related to self-objectification. One of them told me that she dreaded having sex with her husband and never wanted to have sex with him because she had gained weight and she didn't want to be seen. So they almost never had sex. That led into every other area of her life, which is incredibly common for girls and women, regardless of how they actually look to people from the outside. So, you know, they can fit as close to the ideal as you could even imagine. And that literally has nothing to do with how you actually feel about your body. The most beautiful women, as you can imagine, still feel very terribly about their bodies when they're self-objectifying. Another woman, she felt like she desperately needed to get a boob job, breast implants, for her husband so that he would love her more, even though she told me she had a very healthy, happy relationship and her husband had never said anything to her about her breasts in any way. But these are the types of messages that we get. It's kind of this conflation of sexy and sexuality that we see so often, mm-hmm. where it's what you're talking about when you say only a few people reserve the right to be sexy, you know, or to feel sexy. And that's because we live in corporate culture that defines what sexy is and nobody actually fits it. You know, like,
right. Well, and they're trying to sell you products to make sure you feel sexy. So they've got to tell you that you're not sexy enough.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. I think sexuality and sexy have been conflated so much that girls don't understand their, and women don't understand their own sexuality and their own pleasure and their own feelings. Their whole idea of sexuality is how they are looked at by others, how they are consumed, how they are viewed for others' pleasure. And that strikes me as wildly problematic for girls and women.
How would you go ahead and kind of talk about those two terms differently? How would you define sexy versus sexuality?
Sexy is an outsider's view of you. Sexy is fleeting. You might have it for a second, according to an outsider's view, and it can be snatched away just as quickly as you could even imagine. So sexy is a definition bestowed upon you by an onlooker. And that onlooker is generally, it's the male gaze. You know, it is largely a homosexual male's perspective of women. That's what women are sold. That's what sexy looks like to women.
You mean a heterosexual?
Yeah, did I say homosexual?
I think you said, I'm not sure now what you said, but I think
Well, I definitely meant heterosexual.
Heterosexual male gaze. Yes. That's how we're programmed, right? Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
So to be sexy is something bestowed upon you by an outsider's gaze. And sexuality is how you feel. So it's kind of like this beauty redefined mantra that we shout from every rooftop, which is my body is an instrument, not an ornament. And you can think about this in terms of sexuality and sexy too. So in a world where girls and women are programmed to view, to conflate sexuality and sexy, they're living in a world where their bodies are ornaments. They're to be looked at. I guess they'd also be instruments for others' pleasure, but not for their own. But in a world where girls and women can experience healthy sexuality, then their bodies are instruments for their own use, for their own pleasure. Their bodies are not just ornaments to be admired, to be abused, consumed, tossed aside when they don't fit certain definitions. So maybe that's a roundabout way of saying that to me, sexuality is something experienced from the inside.
Yeah. Well, we talk a lot about this in the sex therapy field, is performance.
Yes.
Performance, sexuality versus mindfulness, you know, or yes. Present, being in the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're so worried about how you look. And so you're in the middle of having sex and all of a sudden you're thinking about your love handles or turn off the lights or, am I wearing the right thing or do I look right? And even for those that feel good about their bodies and are proud about certain aspects of their bodies, again, if it's too focused on that particular aspect, it still takes away from your actual experience.
Yes.
You're just kind of in the show-off mode.
Amen.
Versus experience mode.
Yeah, that's what we talk about a lot when we're talking about self-objectification. When women and girls are defined as bodies and valued as bodies, which happens framed in very empowering ways all the time, you know, the fitness inspiration, the body positivity movement, having plus size women in their underwear on social media, it's framed as something that is positive, but it is still revolving around women as bodies, presenting as bodies first and foremost. And if you believe that you are a body, then it just goes back to what you're saying, that you're in this performative mode. What we know from our research is that if you believe you're defined by your body, then you can't get into that flow state that has everything to do with sex as well. That flow state, that state of not thinking about yourself from the outside, but just being in a state of flow, of going, of performance, of, you know, what, maybe I don't have the right words for that, but when you're in a state of self-objectification, whether you like the way your body looks or you don't like the way your body looks, your preference is on an outsider's gaze of yourself. And that stops you from progress in a million different ways.
Right, right. And, you know, and I always try to normalize this a bit because obviously we like to be attractive, right?
Yeah.
And we like feeling sexy and we like feeling that way about our partner, right? Like
Our
partner sexy and attractive and all that. So there's some natural stuff in there that we're not saying all of that is bad, but I think what you're really bringing into focus here is when it's the primary energy that's driving everything. And then, and especially when it leaves you feeling less than
or absolutely
enough.
Yeah.
To enjoy your sexuality. Right.
Yeah. I think that's a really good way of putting it.
All right.
Go ahead. No, you.
Okay. Well, just with the idea of objectification, what I notice a lot is, especially in religiously conservative cultures and, you know, coming from Mormonism myself, when we think about objectification, we think about women scantily clad, you know, on advertisements or billboards, what we would say using, you know, their sexuality or their sexual energy to sell a product.
You know,
we blame the media and we talk about, and that's definitely one component to what's happening in our world. But we don't oftentimes think about the other ways that we objectify, which is where I'd like to move into a conversation about modesty rhetoric.
Oh, yeah.
This idea that, you know, we go the opposite end of the spectrum and we say, okay, well, in order for your body to have value, it needs to be dressed in a certain way. It needs to be covered in a certain way.
Yeah.
And we would probably see a problem with other religions who do this more extreme than ours, you know, like, for example, Islam or, you know, like Amish, or we're like, wow, that's really extreme, you know, that they expect their women to be all covered up. And we can see how that's objectifying, but it's very hard to look from within your own culture and see how you're doing it. So do you want to talk a little bit about modesty rhetoric?
Yes. So Lindsay and I posted about modesty for the first time at Beauty Redefined in 2011. We were talking about the ways that modesty rhetoric inadvertently sexualizes and objectifies girls and women who bear the burden of dress codes of modesty in the church and in other institutions like schools. We posted a post that was very popular a few weeks ago where there was a stake in Salt Lake who had a flyer for their church prom. And on the flyer was one line for the boys that said, "Boys, please wear a shirt and tie and keep your pants pulled up." And then it said "girls." And there was a massive paragraph. We couldn't even post it all when we were reposting it in an image we made about all of the things that they had to cover: their armpits, their backs, 2 inches of shoulders, just more than you could even imagine. And we wrote that it broke our hearts to see that, because that is reinforcing this message that our culture constantly tells girls and women, and that is that they exist to be looked at, that they are bodies first and people second. And we believe that institutions that actually care about girls, especially, you know, something like a church, wouldn't that message be not your body defines you, but that you are more than a body? you aren't your body. We aren't going to preference the male gaze here that your body is inherently sexual. We're going to do better. And yet that's what we see. I get it. You know, I get why so many leaders and well-meaning people want to enforce dress codes because, yeah, we live in a world that begs girls to believe that their ability to be sexy is the best thing about them. That's where they're going to get their value. So of course, it's hard to find clothes that are modest a lot of times. But when we are reinforcing that very sexualization upon them by making everybody, including themselves, look at the parts of them that are showing, that aren't showing, that are suddenly sexualizing shoulders and knees and backs and armpits and every other part, we're really doing the whole world a disservice. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. I've been writing about this for many years as well and talking about it on podcasts as well. And yet, you know, so let me just play the part of the parent, right? Or of the leader. It's like, okay, well, yeah, I get that. I can see that. But boys' clothes, it's like, that's all we have to tell them because we don't have all these options. It's not like we have to say, oh, don't wear a muscle shirt to the prom. Like that's not even culturally normal, right? Like guy is probably going to wear a tuxedo or a suit, right? Or things of that nature. And so I don't have to worry about the guys, you know, wearing shorts that, you know, come almost up to their crotch level, right? And so I, you know, that's just not part of the outfits that are out there for boys really to normally wear. So, yeah, so it's not my fault that the list for the girls is, you know, 3 miles long because all the outfits that are out there for the girls are very different than the outfits that are out there for the boys. So that's one pushback that I'd offer for you to address that.
Yes, we address this because it's important. That's the exact pushback we get. When we first posted this in 2011, Mormons hated us for it. Any conservatives were just incredibly up in arms that we're advocating for people to just be able to run around naked, which sure, do what you want. But we get that dress codes can be very appropriate. And for institutions, yes, it is okay to have a dress code, but we want them to be written in a way that doesn't unnecessarily deconstruct girls specifically into collections of body parts. Now you bring up a larger conversation and it's one that we should definitely be talking about. And that is this larger conversation that girls and women in every industry, in every, basically every culture are being told that their bodies are the most important part about them. And so fashion designers design clothes to highlight the sexual appeal of girls. And that's in crop tops, the tiniest shorts. Yes, it's all in. And that's a bigger conversation where we can be teaching girls and women and boys and men that girls and women are not here to be looked at. They are not sexual objects first and people second. They are not bodies first and people second. We need to reverse that order. So in something like a church dress code, we thought that it would sound a lot more appropriate on something like that church flyer they're handing out to say something like, we all know what our church's dress standards are. You know, you have the For the Strength of Youth pamphlet or whatever it might be. If you don't, let's talk about it. In the meantime, please do your best to find a dress or another outfit that fits those standards, because we want you to be able to focus on dancing, hanging out with your friends, having fun, and not worrying about your dress or your body. And that is the key here. When we can reframe the discussion of modesty, including in the many lessons that the young women are getting about modesty, to reframe how they feel instead of how they look to others, we get somewhere so much better. We can do that by talking about this from a research perspective. Like research tells us that while modesty is very subjective, if you are dressing in a way that is more covered, a little bit more modest for you so that you aren't so fixated on your parts, you know, like when you're wearing something especially revealing or tight, you're still thinking about your body. You're self-objectifying. You're thinking about, do things look right? Does this look how I wanted it to when I looked in the mirror? Or are things not in the right place? You know, when we can talk about how we feel in our bodies and to dress so that we can feel good, so that we can perform better in all of these ways, that is so much more powerful to me.
Yeah, right. And that's kind of inherently already baked in for boys in a way.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. If you look at the fashion industry or anything else, boys and men, I mean, yes, some experience self-objectification, but by and large, when we're talking about this in large university audiences, the boys and men are shocked to hear about self-objectification. And so many of the girls and women in the audiences are choked up because we are articulating something that they have experienced their whole lives that they just thought was normal. They just thought that was part of their psyche, that was part of everybody's experience in their bodies. And it's not, and it doesn't have to be. I mean, of course, self-objectification will always play some role in our lives because it would be very hard to escape that unless you lived by yourself, nobody ever saw you, and you didn't consume any media at all whatsoever.
Right.
But we don't live in that world.
Right. So, I mean, objectification in a way is just a form of labeling, which our brains kind of do naturally anyway, right? We organize data and we put people and things into boxes and we organize all of that information. So there is a natural aspect of objectification, but what we're talking about is something that's gotten so extreme and so prevalent and so primary that then that's the primary way of organizing something. And we want to be more than just that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That aspect of ourselves. Okay. And then on the other side of the spectrum, then of this argument of the modesty, it's like, well, you know, I want to honor my kids. I want to honor my daughters. I don't want to objectify them by, you know, making them feel super strict about what they wear. But at what point is that, is, you know, should I not have any limits? Should I, you know, as a parent especially, should I just be okay with whatever they say they feel comfortable with, even though I'm not comfortable with what they're wearing? You know, so what are some ways that you talk about that particular issue? So somebody who's like recognizing the problem and wants to support their daughters, but still feels like they have a parental role.
Yeah, of course. I think it's important to ask the girl herself why she's wearing what she's wearing, like what motivated it. And I think that can get you to somewhere important. If she is wearing the tiny shorts and the crop top, and you're talking about this from kind of a dress code perspective, like of appropriateness, you can first start with, well, why are you wearing this? And is it, if she says something like, it's because I look cute, it's because I'm skinny and this looks good, or, you know, whatever it might be, a lot of times that is all going to revolve around how she appears to others. And that's a really important opportunity to share the empowering message with her that she is not an ornament for anybody else's viewing pleasure, that she is important. She has important things to do and words to say and things to do, and that her valuing herself primarily for how she appears is exactly what industries that hate her want her to do. Like, I think that especially teenagers, they want to rebel against this crap. They want to rebel against these powerful industries that are co-opting their power and selling it back to them. So I think that's one way to do it. I think it's just really important to talk about things in terms of appropriateness for the situation. So if your daughter wants to wear a bikini to go to the pool, I mean, we don't ask boys to wear that little of clothing. So I hate that girls feel the pressure to have to wear so little clothing when they're swimming, because I want them to experience the joy of swimming and their bodies as instruments instead of ornaments. But I think in some cases, if she feels like that is appropriate, maybe let her, and then have the conversation afterward. Maybe watch her. And if she's constantly pulling her bikini bottoms out of her butt and constantly adjusting her top to make sure that everything looks right, have a candid conversation afterward and talk about how she felt. Did she have a lot of fun? Did she feel self-conscious? Did she feel, you know, caught up in how other people might be viewing her instead of just really experiencing the joy and fun of swimming? You know, I think that's one way to put it, but I know it's different for every parent and for every girl or woman.
Yeah, I like that. I like the opportunity for conversation and for exploration and for allowing our teens to kind of make some of these decisions and see what it's like for them.
Yeah.
Without necessarily having always those decisions made for them, especially when you're looking at 15, 16, 17 year olds. I mean, within a few years, they're going to be off making their own choices anyway. And so why not practice some of that while they're still at home?
And I think, if I can jump in, I think that allowing them to make their own choices, you know, in that bikini situation, if you freak out that she bought a bikini or that she borrowed a bikini from her friend and and you're freaking out about it. Like, no, this is the worst. You're practically naked. You are instilling this idea that her sexuality is everything, that it is, you know, the most powerful and dangerous thing about her. You're instilling this idea that people are going to look at her. And, you know, I think that that all results in shame. And that will oftentimes lead to that girl, when she is off with her friends alone or when she's at college, to believe that her body is, again, the most important thing about her, that her sexiness is everything. And so she is going to go down that shame spiral that tells her that her body is most important. I don't know if I'm articulating that well, but
yeah, no, you are. You are. And again, I always want to put in the other side of things, because I want people to, like, your whole instrument versus ornament. I love that. I think that's a great way to put that. That's a very visual kind of, you know, I like things like that stick in my brain.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I do think that there is something that we're probably never going to get away from, in the sense of wanting to be attractive, right?
Yes.
One of the problems that I see a lot of times with Mormon women in my office is that they did the good girl thing while they were teenagers, right?
Yeah.
They wore the t-shirts and, you know, nothing that was revealing their shoulders, and they wore the one pieces and, you know, as far as bathing suits and all that, and they felt modest and they felt, you know, righteous in that sense. And then it comes to wedding night,
yeah, right,
or marriage and sexuality, and maybe this desire to want to feel sexy or like sensual, and not even knowing how to tap into that aspect of themselves. Like,
yeah,
the idea of wearing lingerie or of being flirtatious or of, you know, wiggling their breasts a little bit, you know,
yeah,
husbands, like all of that is like, oh my gosh, that feels so foreign to me, right? Or almost like pornographic, or,
yeah,
like, you know what I'm saying? So I'm always like wanting to have a foot in each department.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like,
oh, totally. Yes. So one question we get all the time after speaking events, especially from really well-meaning guys and husbands, is, I love my wife and I'm worried that I'm objectifying her.
Like, right. Like, I like her in that red teddy.
I know. And I mean, maybe this is problematic, but my first instinct is to say that if you love her, like if you love her, that means that you don't just love her boobs, you know, or you don't just love her butt, or you don't just love having sex with her. You like actually love her. And I think it's really hard to objectify somebody that you love. That's sexuality. That's good and fun and brings so much joy and happiness. Like, of course, girls and women want to feel attractive. I think the idea of feeling attractive for somebody who loves you is very different from the idea of self-objectification, which takes you outside of your own body and brings shame and pain into your life. I think I need to better articulate that or figure out how, because I think that's really important. And I hear what you're saying. So many conservative and Mormon girls and women do have a hard time with sex because of that. And men often do too. You know, they're worried about objectifying their partner, but maybe you can speak more to that. But I feel like it's really hard to objectify somebody that you love.
I love that you said that. I think that's the perfect thing to say.
Okay.
Because I do think, you know, if you think about it from a perspective that maybe is more okay, quote, you know, I wish everybody could see me doing my but in other words, like if you're a woman and your husband all of a sudden is dressed up in a suit, right, that he doesn't typically wear,
yeah,
and he's looking pretty, you know, snazzy, and you're like, wow, you know, he's looking pretty snazzy and I'm kind of excited to see him that way,
or
even the reverse, right, like where he's normally in a suit but now he's in his like
basketball shorts
and his muscle shirt and he's about to work out, and you're like, wow, you know, that's kind of cool and I like that. That's not you objectifying your husband.
No.
That's you having an attraction and noticing him in a little bit of a different way than he normally presents himself, which again, we're wired to do that. That's why lingerie is fun. That's why fantasy play is fun, right? That's why a lot of these things are fun. It's because they're a little bit different than what we're normally day to day doing. And so our brain is like, ooh, that's special. That's arousing. That's fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that that's really a good way to.
Okay.
To
good. Because I'm sure it's possible for someone to objectify someone they love. But for the most part, like, especially from a guy or a girl asking that question, like actually asking the question, being worried that they're objectifying somebody, that tells me they're not, like, they care about that person. That's why they even have the question in their head. I don't know. I hear that question a lot, but I personally, you know, if we can be personal.
Oh, I love being personal.
Okay. I got married when I was 27 and I was a virgin and my husband was too. He was 25 and we have like a great healthy sex life. I won't say anything more because I don't want to embarrass him, but everything's great. And I hear this question all the time about girls who are worried about being sexy or having sex with their husbands. They feel shame about that. And I don't know where in my upbringing I missed that. I mean, I felt the same. I was relatively modest growing up, and yet maybe it was because I was older a little older in quotes when I got married, but I totally missed any opportunity to feel like sex was bad or wrong or shameful, or being attractive to my husband was somehow being objectified. I missed that. And I'm glad I did.
Yeah. And I thought about this because obviously there's people that share your experience where they feel like actually the modesty teachings or the teachings about, you know, chastity were very helpful to them, that they were very protective, that they felt very empowered to be able to, you know, decide when and where they would be sexual, you know, and so it was a very positive experience for them.
Oh, but I get that for many,
the great majority, at least that I work with, I don't know, you know, if we were going to do a complete study on it, but the great majority don't feel that way. And I think again, because some of it might just be personality, you know, just like some people have just a stronger personality or a more personality that's in tune with their own kind of autonomy.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of times these messages are otherized, you know, so in other words, do this so that you can keep God happy, you know, so that you can keep your husband happy, do this so that you can keep your parents happy. It's not so much about do this so that you can be empowered as an individual. And, and I know Jennifer Finlayson Fife, this is kind of her dissertation work where she found that a lot of it had to do with whether or not the motivation was internalized or externalized as to whether or not those messages were helpful or not.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally get that for the majority. I see it all the time. It's very difficult to grow up, you know, modest and chaste and all those, you know, subjective things, and then be able to embrace sexuality in a healthy way. The work you do is so important for that.
Oof. Yeah. Another theory that has been thrown out there that I don't know if it's been researched, but is that there's a lot of identity in being modest and chaste as a young religious woman. Mm-hmm. And when you have sex, even with your husband for the first time, there's a sense that you've lost something. Like there's that, even if you've done it correctly, right? Like, in my air quotes, correctly, waiting till marriage, there's a part of your identity that you're no longer that virginal, pure, innocent, modest.
Yeah.
But now you're a sexual woman. And a lot of, I don't know that women know how to make that transition.
Wow. That is so interesting. That's probably a dissertation study for some
sort of thing,
all on its own. It would be interesting to see the motivations for why girls and women remain like even just modest, why they dress modestly growing up. For me, I mean, maybe some of it was like, I'm Mormon. I want to stand out. I'm different. You know, my identity was very much around like wanting to be a leader and an example because that's my personality. But a lot of the reasons why I dressed modestly was because I was self-conscious of my body. So it was easy to be modest because I had to be, you know, like if I was asked to be modest, then that's fine. But I wonder if I had really felt internally motivated or externally motivated by God or whatever, if that would be different.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting. Well, I'd like to spend the rest of the time really focusing in on these ideas that you bring up about resilience, which I love that word, and how to, you know, that you felt it was really important not just to bring up the topic and we can all nod and say, yep, this is a problem, and Yeah. And oftentimes that's kind of where the conversation ends.
It is.
But what can we do about it? Are we powerless, you know, against this? Obviously, media is not going anywhere. Honesty rhetoric really isn't going anywhere. We have these issues both, you know, kind of all over the spectrum. And so what can we as women, as parents, do about it for our own lives and for our daughters' lives?
There's so much we can do. It is so uplifting. Doing this research, you know, it can be incredibly emotionally draining to be steeped in this research about self-objectification and see how many girls and women are suffering and in all of these ways and just not see a way out. But in doing my dissertation study where I developed this theoretical model of body image resilience and self-objectification resilience as a way out.
Is that what you were testing, by the way? So you were testing to see if this particular model could actually help people.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And we now run it as an 8-week online program on our website, and we're debuting one for therapists soon for group therapy. So that's what we're working on now. But basically, in both me and Lindsay's research, we found this shining ray of light in the midst of all of this sad research. And that was that about 10% of girls and women feel positively toward their bodies. And that 10% figure, it stands up against, you know, a lot of other research. That 10% figure, when we dug into these women that were somehow resilient in the face of all of the crap that we all go through, you know, it's not like they grew up in a basement where they weren't surrounded by these cultural ideals and these media ideals. It was just the opposite. When we dug into these resilient women, what makes girls and women resilient in the face of these hard body image challenges, we found that they were resilient because of the pain they had experienced in their bodies. There's so many examples. There was one woman who, she told me in confidence that she had been sexually assaulted when she was young. And for a long time, that was kind of the crutch she used to drag around behind her that kept her in really unhealthy, unhappy relationships, that kept her feeling like her body was a weapon that had been used against her. So she did not treat herself well. I'm sure that amounted to things we see in research like self-harm, disordered eating, you know, the list goes on. She told me that when she got to college, she decided to volunteer for an organization that helped other girls and women who had been sexually assaulted. And she said in doing that, she found her mission. She found her purpose. It was in shining a light on her pain and actually volunteering with girls and women who had experienced that same pain that she found that she could be more compassionate and more purpose-driven and fulfilled than she ever could have been without experiencing that really terrible thing. That was just one example of many. But what it told us as we dug into resilience is that we can be stronger as girls and women because of this objectifying crap, because of it, not in spite of it. We don't have to drag it around our whole lives behind us, self-objectifying along the way, but we can harness resilient traits that get us someplace better. And I can give you a few examples of what those are.
Yes, please.
Some of these different strategies we harness. One is in terms of our mental health and our mental strength. And that is a strategy we use that we call going on a media fast. And I'm sure you've heard that, and probably lots of your listeners have too. But if you are experiencing any sort of self-objectification in your life, and if you consume media of any form, it is so powerful to take at least 3 days. Just stay away from every form of media you can, especially social media, especially body-centric content that happens on social media. And as you step away from it, you very quickly get resensitized to messages that hurt you, that keep you self-objectifying, that keep you in this state of believing that your body is your most important asset. When you step back, then you are able to unsubscribe, unfollow, hide from every other message that is making you feel that way. And you take your power back in this little way. Lots of girls and women in our studies and beyond that have experienced major body image resilience by taking a regular media fast, like even once a month. It's very powerful.
That really backs up like the neuroscience approach that shares this idea that our brain is so fluid.
Oh, yeah.
We're not as fixed as we think we are. You know, sometimes we think, oh, I'll never be able to get out of this type of thought process or this habit, or that our brain is extremely resilient. And so by just taking a short break like that, I mean, that's true of all kinds of issues.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Erectile dysfunction, masturbation. There's all kinds of things that people are like, oh my gosh, I'm addicted. And I'm like, take a 3-day break. You'd be surprised.
Absolutely. We get those emails too.
how quickly your brain kind of reprograms itself.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. It's so important. We've just found that to be such a key to kind of harnessing this resilience that kind of gets tamped down when you are just stuck, like so many girls and women in social media kind of whirlwind. It's the constant. It's the wallpaper of our lives. And to be able to be more critical is everything. Another thing that we encourage people to do in terms of your mental might and your mental power is to be very critical of every message you're consuming, especially again on social media and the cultural messages, like the things that we say to each other as women. We ask people to just ask themselves, even out loud to friends, some critical questions. Like sometimes we ask people to flip the script. Would a man ever pose like that in an Instagram post? Or do we sell these products to men? I think about eyelashes. Men largely, I mean, I know that I'm probably generalizing, but most boys and men do not think about their eyelashes. They don't think about the thickness or the length or the fullness or the sexiness of their lashes. They don't put anything on their lashes throughout their entire lives. And girls and women, we've bought into this lie that the longer, thicker, sexier lashes are, they're sexier, they're more beautiful. And so most of us spend every day looking at our eyelashes and paying for products to put on them. And I think when we flip the script in some of these ways, you can think about it in terms of anti-aging creams and potions. That's a more than $1 billion a year industry targeted at women and not men. We see how so many industries have co-opted women, have sold us flaws and then sold us solutions to them. And men just are not targeted in the same way. And that kind of stokes your anger and your feminist fire and helps you kind of want to rebel against these things and just be more critical of messages in general.
Right. Okay. So I'm going to push back right there on you because I'm seeing pictures of you on your website and you're very beautiful, as is your sister. And you're obviously wearing makeup and you're obviously wearing clothing, you know, that is fashionable and fun. And so how do you, again, how do you create that balance between, you know, I'm never wearing any eye mascara again in my life because that would be a damage to my body image versus I'm going to wear it every day and it's going to be a huge part of whether or not I feel good enough, right?
So where's good question. Yes, well, we address this a lot too. I think the best thing you can do in being very critical of every ideal you buy into is to ask yourself why you're doing it. And if it's rooted in shame, it might not be in your best interest. So if we take mascara for an example, I would ask and challenge each girl or woman who regularly wears mascara to go one day, step out of the house without mascara and prove to yourself that life is still worth living, that people still look at you and talk to you, that you are still a full-blown thinking, feeling human. And when you do that, you learn that if it's really scary, you learn what shame, like how much shame has a hold on your life. And if it's not really scary and it's okay, that shame kind of lets up. And that's a good thing. It also helps people looking at you to see that girls and women have the same eyelashes as boys and men, and that we don't just look sick when we don't have makeup on. That's actually just our faces. You know, so many people say, oh, are you not feeling good? No, this is reality. So that's one way. I think it's important to ask yourself why you're doing what you're doing. And the other thing is everybody has to draw that line of what beauty work they do for themselves. I think the first step is being cognizant of taking inventory of everything you do in the name of beauty work. I put that in quotes. Mm. It's a burden that is placed on girls and women from the time they are tiny. It's the makeup, the anti-aging, the tanning if you're white. It's the skin lightening if you're dark. It's the hair removal below your eyelashes if you're a woman. It's all of these things. Our bodies are being used against us in consumer culture. And I think when you take inventory of those things, you can rebel against some of these ideals that are designed to keep us fixated as bodies alone on your own time. So for me, that means, number one, I do not diet. I'm anti-diet. And that has been a long time coming. I spent my whole life dieting. But I do not want to be in a binging and restricting cycle that I experienced for so much of my life. So I don't diet. And that means that my body stays at a size that many would probably deem not attractive. I don't care. Right. That's one thing. Right. I do wear some makeup, but I draw the line that if beauty hurts me, I'm not going to do it. So I don't do any sort of laser hair removal because it's painful. And if you argue with me that it's not painful, I'm also going to tell you I do it because I want my baby girl to see that her mom has leg hair because she's going to have leg hair. And I want her to know that she doesn't have to remove all of her hair on her body just to be normal like her mom. So I don't want to raise that bar for her or for anybody else that's looking at me. So yeah, I shave my legs. I don't shave them all the time. I don't grow them out all the way because that's a line I've chosen to draw for myself. I buy into patriarchy. I have to stand up in front of people and do media appearances, and my body is visible to a lot of people. But I draw the line at pain. So I, at this point in my life, have chosen that I am not going to take part in any cosmetic surgery. I do that because of my stance at Beauty Redefined, that is a burden placed upon women that hits us in our pocketbooks. It hits our health. It hits us in every imaginable way. So I draw the line there, but I'm not going to shame or blame any woman for what they do in the name of beauty, because I know how hard it is to live in this world and not feel beautiful or be deemed beautiful by other people. But it's important to me to be able to be critical of the choices I'm making. How's that for an answer?
Yeah, I love that answer. I think it's a very personalized answer. I mean, I would say a lot of those same things. You know, I was letting my hair go gray for a while. Yeah. And then I was like, I just don't feel as attractive and as young and as energized. And I know that that message is lame. And I don't think I'll forever color my hair, you know, because I actually find gray hair quite beautiful.
I do too.
A lot of women really pull it off in wonderful ways. And right now for me, I'm just going to color my hair, even though I know, like you're saying, that I'm buying into the system, you know, and that's going to be what I do. Same with hair removal. That's always been something I've thought about, you know, even like plastic surgery. I mean, it's always interesting to me how we're so comfortable with certain things like braces. You know, most of us get braces and we don't even think twice about it. I don't even think we think about it from an objectifying perspective.
But braces aren't sexist. Like, girls,
everybody does it. Yeah.
Yeah, they all do it. And I think that is an important way to determine if something is just largely burdening girls and women.
Right, right. And at the same time, I would say, like, the area where I feel like I really try not to be judgmental at all is with breast size.
Yeah.
First of all, because there's women with very large breasts who have a lot of chronic back pain.
And
obviously that's kind of becomes a medical issue. And so, you know, going through a surgery where they're more comfortable with their body and their body is more maybe
yes,
feeling like they can run and they can do things without having to wear, you know, huge amounts of support and things.
Yeah.
And then also on the other side, you know, where I've had, you know, size A or even, I don't know if there's anything less than size A, but
double A,
feel like, you know, I don't even know that I feel like a woman because my breasts never really developed.
Yeah.
And so I want to give that gift to myself to feel more womanly because I really, you know, identify as a woman and identify in that way. And I'm totally supportive of that too. But I think what you're getting at is the constant nitpicking at the perfection that a lot of times I think cosmetic surgery is about.
Yes.
Where, you know, just here nips and tucks and the aging process that we're all uncomfortable with. And again, it's a balance that I think everybody has to figure out, like you've said.
It is a balance. I think in terms of cosmetic surgery, that's really hard because I preface this by saying, like, I do not want to shame or blame any woman for what they do in the name of beauty work, in the name of feeling normal, even not sexy, just normal. Right. But it is so important to interrogate those ideals because those ideals burden girls and women. Like with breast implants alone, where Mormons get more breast implants than anybody else. I mean, if we just look at that in terms of stats, Salt Lake City has more plastic surgeons per capita than anywhere else in the country. We have a very cheap surgery here. So about 20% of cosmetic surgery are people coming in from California and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But we also have a population of women who are the youngest moms in the country, and they have the most babies in the country per capita. They also have a lot of excess income, largely, and they have a little bit of excess time because we have a population of women who are homemakers more than the national average.
Mm-hmm. And
all of this leads up to this idea that plastic surgeons call the mommy makeover. And it is a real thing. It is something that is important to discuss here. So many very conservative girls and women, very religious girls and women are planning a boob job. or have a boob job. And they say they do it for me. And I get it. But when I interrogate, what does that mean for me? It's largely for how you look. It's for how your clothes fit. It's so you can feel better about your body. But when you dig in, what does that mean? I'm going to tell a personal story. When I was, before I was married, before I was dating anybody in my early 20s, or maybe even a little bit earlier, I really felt like I needed cosmetic surgery. Like I felt like I needed liposuction for sure. Mm-hmm. And I had a person ask me, if you knew that your partner, like your future husband or somebody seeing you naked that you loved, if you knew that they loved your body right now, just the way it is, that they were attracted to you, they wanted to have sex with you, would you still get this done? And I said, no. Hmm. And I think if you ask yourself that question and you say no, I can promise you cosmetic surgery is not going to help you feel better about your body. You can fix that on the inside through body image resilience, because most people that have cosmetic surgery go back for another procedure because you're not just automatically fixed in quotes. Right. So I would just ask women to interrogate that just a little, because the cost of cosmetic surgery, the cost of breast implants that need to be redone every 10 years is a massive cost to women.
Right. Well, and the cost that, to your point, that it may not be fixing the problem to begin with.
Yeah.
Right. So, which is if we continue to keep that primary motivation of how others will view us, then
we're never
going to be enough.
Yeah.
We're never going to be enough. All right. So maybe we have time for one more strategy that you, cut you off at the last one because I wanted to talk.
Oh, no, you're fine. Let's talk about, a really important one is along the lines of viewing your body as an instrument, not an ornament. That is a mantra that if everybody could internalize, it would change the world. So we find through research that women often lead sedentary lives and refuse to exercise because they feel, in quotes, too fat to exercise. Or if they don't feel too fat, they feel bloated, or they don't have the right clothes to wear to the gym, or they are largely worried about being looked at. So many women sit out of physical activities. They also sit out of leadership positions and going up for, in politics because they don't want to be looked at, and so many other things. But if you can internalize this mantra, and if we think about this in terms of our physical power, if you use your body as an instrument instead of an ornament, that means that you are not going to rely on a number on the scale or a measurement or a dress size to determine your health, because those are actually objectifying measures that don't actually tell you anything about your health. Instead, use your body as an instrument by setting fitness goals. And these can be anything you want, whether it's, I'm going to walk around the block with my friend 5 times this month, or I'm going to swim this many miles this week, or any number of things. Have it be about what your body can do. And as you do that, you break away from those really objectifying and often shame-inducing measures that don't have anything to do with health. And you feel the joy that comes from moving your body, actually, feeling intuitive movement and experiencing your body as an instrument, getting in that flow state. It helps your health and your physical power in ways that is incredibly vital to your body image resilience.
I love that. And I'll share a personal experience with this. So, I've gone up and down my weight most of my adult life, and, which is always lovely. And I love to dance. And at the same time, I've got plantar fasciitis, so I've got problems with my feet. So that's one reason why I don't want to get up and move, is my feet hurt. And then the other reason is that idea of, well, I'm not thin enough, or, sexy enough, or I don't look the part of a dancer, so I can't go dance. Well, several years ago, I decided to kick that idea to the curb, like you're saying, resilience, right? And I just started attending this Zumba class at the YMCA, right? Oh. At first, I was in the very back row and I could barely move, I could do my little thing a little bit in the back, and everybody would be like light years ahead of me. And I was just really persistent about just getting myself there. And, you're right. And the movement helped me feel better. I mean, I still have my foot pain I had to deal with, but, I looked, for other things that would make me feel better. Well, 2 years later, I'm at the front of the row.
Yes.
I've lost some weight, which is fine. That wasn't necessarily my initial goal, was to lose weight. I just wanted to feel stronger and not feel so lethargic. And as I'm looking around now, as my confidence has built, you know, I see a lot of women in there. We're all different shapes and sizes. We're all over the map. And it's so fun to see the women who are confident. And again, not always are the skinny women the confident ones doing it in there. And it's also interesting to see some of the women kind of start out like I did, you know, in the back row. And maybe not exactly the body type you think for Zumba. And yet, you know, they come week after week and you can see them getting stronger and you can see them really enjoying the movement and the dance.
Yes.
And for me, Zumba is sensual, you know, so there's that sexual energy with it too, not about my partner, but about me, about tapping into my own sensuality and how I can feel sensual in an individual way as well. So I just want to offer that as a personal story to kind of back up what you're saying.
I love it.
It's so healthy and doing it for our own selves is so healthy. And when you really look around, like we're surrounded by beautiful women of all shapes and sizes, and like we're all really cool.
Oh, I love it. I feel the power in what you're saying because I've experienced myself. I've experienced it through Zumba and through swimming and through running, through any number of things. And I guess this would be a place, if it's okay, I would plug our TED Talk, which is where
Please plug away.
Thank you. So Salt Lake TED invited Beauty Redefined to do the final TED Talk this year. And they would only let one of us do it. So Lindsay got to do it, but she killed it. And I think it is really powerful. And she articulates a lot of things that we've talked about today.
And I will link to that.
Thank you. Yes. Including her own personal experience of body image resilience with swimming and, you know, getting her physical power that way. It's really good. I can say that as a twin that is very competitive.
Good. And then tell us a little bit too more about Plug Your 8-Week Program. Like if people are interested in something like that, what would that offer and what would people walk away from in that regard having done that?
So the 8-week program is available on our website. It's the course on our website. It's for individuals and it's all online. So you engage with a lot of text, videos. We just recorded audio of all of it as well. There's surveys that are responsive. You go through 8 weeks, you take it at your own pace. It's just for you. So engage with it on your own timeline over the course of a year. It costs $150, which if you're thinking about this in terms of therapy, that's nothing for a year of content. It's really the culmination of everything we do at Beauty Redefined. And we've gotten a lot of great feedback from it. So if that's something you're interested in, please do engage with that online. And for therapists, we're debuting this facilitator guide for therapists of all varieties to use in group therapy. You'll get referral on our website and be able to reference yourself as a Beauty Redefined body image guide. I think that's going to be really helpful because we have had our door knocked down by therapists wanting to use this program. So
awesome. Well, that's wonderful. I'm so glad to hear of your success and the messages you're being successful at getting out there. And we're up with our time, which is oh so sad, but what would be your kind of some closing thoughts that you'd like to leave us with, or maybe something I didn't ask you about that you're hoping to share?
That's a good question. I feel like I just did so much talking.
You did great.
But I think I would just leave with that message that I repeated a million times that I want everybody to believe. And that is that women are more than bodies. And when we can see more in our own internalized ideals, in the cultural messages that surround us, that try to convince us otherwise, then that lays this amazing foundation for us to be more. Women have amazing power and potential. And I do this as an advocate for women because I believe in us so much. And I believe in our purpose and our power and potential that comes when we can get out of this prison of being stuck in self-objectification. I know what we're capable of. I feel it. I get goosebumps thinking about it. And of course, I love and believe in men too, but my heart is with the women. I believe in us. And I know what we can do if we step outside of this space.
Well, that's wonderful. You've been listening to Lexi Kite from Beauty Redefined at Mormon Sex Info. We're so glad you were able to be on our program. This was a lovely interview, and I hope all of our listeners found it very valuable. We will hopefully cross paths someday, I hope.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being on. Goodbye. Thank you.
turned minutes into miles. And as the evening traveled on, the sunset bathed your smile. We stopped beneath the desert stars, wrapped in each other's arms. Was as simple as I love you, an ordinary, extraordinary truth.
It's been a long road here, a trail with tears, pain and sorrow too.
But through every storm like lovers do. And if sometimes we fell apart, we always came back home. Was as simple as I love you, an ordinary, extraordinary. Some people say, love is blind, and forever it's too long. But I see your eyes in every sunrise, can't imagine life alone. Want you by my side till the day I die and into the beyond. It's as simple as our love is. That's how I wanna go. All wrapped up in the arms of are extraordinary. It's nothing ordinary love. Ordinary.
Ordinary.
No, it's extraordinary.